5 minutes after one, the House Judiciary Committee is in session. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Herron, Representative Rammers, and Representative Dahlstrom. Excused are Representative Gatto and Representative Holmes. We are honored today to have with us the Minority Leader, Representative Curtula. What a privilege it is to have you in our committee room. We appreciate that. We also are honored to have some young close-up students, and there are three of you. We're going to go, we're going to take a brief at ease. What are your names? On the record, we've been joined by three of our colleagues, our newest colleagues, three new bold Alaskans whose names we're going to get in just a couple minutes. Can you offer your names for the record, please?
Tiana Peterson.
Billy Nooncaster.
Kelly Evans.
Excellent. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee on a sunny Friday in Juneau. It is a privilege. It is a privilege to have you here. Madam Minority Leader, if you don't mind, we are going to very quickly dispense of the youth court bill. First up this afternoon is House Bill 331, Youth Court Finding. Are any of the three of you involved in the youth court in your schools? Do you have youth court in your communities?
We have it, yeah.
Do? Excellent.
You take your Fifth Amendment again, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Haven't we all, Representative Lynn?
The last time I took a fifth was a while
back. Terry, if you would benefit of our guests, just take us through 60 seconds of what the youth court funding bill does, and then I presume that somebody has an amendment to offer.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terry Harvey, legislative aide to Representative Munoz. This bill is offers a means to fund the youth court by the use of a portion of criminal fines collected. It is a means for sustainability for this very important alternative program in Alaska's juvenile justice system. And we have had the opportunity to speak with Representative Gruenberg on an issue in the bill that we feel that we are in agreement with, and we believe there's an amendment that we certainly are amenable to. So with that, sir, is there anything else I could offer?
No, Terry, thank you. Thank you very much. We're open to amendments. Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, I'm writing this out for the record, but I'll just read it. Amendment number one, will this be, Mr. Chair?
This would be amendment number one.
Okay. It is on page one, line 25. Between appropriate,
do you have the copy of the bill in front of you? Okay. Representative Gruenberg, stand by.
Sorry.
You can keep writing.
You can write it.
Yeah, it's written. She's distributing it.
We'll take a brief at ease.
All right, Mayor.
Offer amendment number one to House Bill 331. Would you point out the place of reference?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's being distributed. But it's very simple. It's on page 1, line 10. Thank you for pointing that out. It's after appropriate and before 25. Insert the phrase up to.
And I will object for the purposes of discussion. Do you see on page 1, line 10? Did you locate that?
Yes.
And the legislature may appropriate 25%, so I have objected for the purposes of discussion. Representative Gruenberg, would you explain to the committee, including our guests, the difference between the language as it presently reads, may appropriate 25% of the fines imposed under AS 12.55, and what the difference would be by inserting the words up to 25%?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glad to. This will eliminate a possible misinterpretation of the bill. It would be possible to interpret it without the amendment in a manner that's illogical. Somebody could say, if you appropriate any amount, it must be 25%. And this will make it clear that the legislature can appropriate any figure between 0 and 25%. And if we tried to limit the power of appropriation, that would not be constitutional, because one legislature cannot limit the power of another legislature to appropriate money.
Thank you, Representative Gruber. Would one of you like to ask the bill sponsor why it's not 50 or 75 or 100%? And would one of you feel comfortable to do that?
Sure. Why not?
Take an Eddie's for just a second.
We'll take an Eddie's for just a moment. We're back on the record. Representative Herron.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terry, in your youth, would it have been good to have youth court for anything that you'd done in those years?
Representative Herron, through the chair. I can recall a moment in my life, in my youth, when a youth court opportunity would have been very helpful for me. It would have offered, excuse me, if you will, Mr. Chairman, it would have offered me the opportunity to learn a little more about the situation I may have found myself in and find a more reasonable means to make amends, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Follow up to that question, Terry. I think we would all benefit from the specifics. No, I'm just kidding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A moment of levity is always appreciated.
Yes, sir. All right. Are there any questions from our newest members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruber.
While we're waiting, I have a technical amendment. The amendment, I had the line wrong. It should be line 10, not line 25, and I'd ask the record be reflected.
Great. Page 1, line 10. So noted, Susan.
Who wants to ask a question?
Tiana?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Yeah, through the chair.
Yes.
Terry, how many students in Alaska participate in this youth court?
Tiana, and through the chair, I do not have that exact number, but I'm sorry, sir.
About 1,000.
About 1,000. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that. I appreciate the question. It's very well utilized by many young folks in Alaska.
Indeed it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. And a follow-up on that is that youth court in our state consistently has an average rate of 8% recidivism, meaning that out of 100 young people that go through youth court, 92% of them do not reoffend. And that's what makes it so successful. And every young person that goes through youth court saves the state court system about $10,000 per person that would otherwise have to go through our court system, and allows the court to concentrate on offenders at the felony level. Because in order to go to youth court, you have to have your felony pled down to a misdemeanor. So, for instance, if somebody stole an iPod, which is a value of more than $100 or $125, whatever the schedule is, the court has to consent to allow it to be pled down to a misdemeanor level, which is a certain, not breaking the threshold of a certain monetary level, in order for it to be a misdemeanor so that it can go before the youth court. And a youth court is made up of a tribunal of 3 judges. And we learned yesterday from 2 of the people that came before the committee that you may participate as a bailiff or as an attorney. Beginning in your freshman year, that there's no hierarchy of freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year, that it's open to all. There's different access points depending on your how comfortable you are. Are there any other questions for Terry? All right. Is there any other discussion of the amendment? I will remove my objection to amendment number 1. So with that, without objection, amendment number 1 passes. We now have the bill, House Bill 331 before us. Is there any discussion on House Bill 331? Seeing none, the chair would look for a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill number 331, version 26-LS1426 /R with attached Joe physical note and amended.
As amended. So without objection, House Bill 331 passes from committee. And we'll take a brief at ease.
Thank you.
On the record now. It's 1:25. We're back on the record. It is a great privilege to invite the Minority Leader, Beth Curtula, Representative Curtula, up to the committee for House Bill number 52. I think Jane is probably getting copies of House Bill 52 for the three of you. And Kayla, you're here. I'll point out to you that we do have time for this exercise within the 90-day session. Yes, ma'am.
I just want you to know that all of these students are no longer, that is closed for the day, and these students are here on their own board.
Excellent. Right. Bonus for us.
Yeah.
Representative Curtula, what a privilege to have you before the committee. And if you would introduce your aide and yourself for the record and present House Bill 52.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, our new guests. It's an honor to be here, and thank you for hearing House Bill 52. House Bill 52 came about as a result of my friend and constituent, Mindy Lobaugh, who will be here to testify in a moment. I apologize, let me introduce my counsel and aide Hannah McCarty, too, and she'll be presenting the actual bill. But it came about as a result of Mindy Lobaugh, my friend and constituent, having been on the Waterman jury. And it was a particularly difficult case with many, many difficult facts. And when she came to talk with me, her experiences on that jury brought back a lot of memories of having been a public defender for 5 years and having thought about not just my own trauma, but also the trauma that jurors sometimes go through. So Mindy had suggested that it might be a good idea to offer jurors on particularly difficult cases some counseling. And I have worked with the court system for a couple of years and decided that the best route to go was introducing legislation so that they would be able to create a program, work with jurors when the judges felt it necessary, and that's what this bill would do. I appreciate the, court system stepping up to the bat and working with us. And also, just in closing and turning it over to Hannah to present the actual language of the bill, we ask citizens to do this, and it's part of our American civic duty, I believe. But I don't think that we expect anyone to wind up in the situation that some people absolutely do, and that is traumatized by some of the particularly difficult cases that we now unfortunately have before them. So I'd appreciate your support. I'm going to be here while Hannah testifies. We can certainly try to answer questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll just take a brief at ease for one moment, please, Hannah. Back on the record, it's 1:30. Hannah, if you'll introduce yourself for the record and present House Bill 52, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Hannah McCarty, staff to Representative Curtula, and I just wanted to give a few details about the bill.
Thank you.
And discuss a program in King County that's offering similar services.
Thank you very much,
Hannah. We'll start with the first page of the bill, line 6. It talks about how the trial judge may offer not more than 10 hours of post-trial psychological counseling without charge to a juror who serves on a trial where they experience graphic, gruesome, or emotional evidence or testimony. And that could be in the form of pictures.
Question on that.
Or in the form of a witness's testimony.
Excuse me, Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hannah, I support the concept that you're presenting here, but is extraordinarily a definition in the statutes?
Representative Herron, through the chair, I have not looked that up, so I will have to get back to you on that because I'm not exactly sure if it is.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, is that graphic, gruesome, and emotional, and the chairman has explained that it's for the extreme, and so just that question.
See how we're on line 8 of the bill, and it says a trial involving extraordinarily graphic, gruesome, or emotional evidence or testimony. So the issue that we're considering is whether the word extraordinarily is a legal term or if it's an adjective, and it may be that a member of the committee makes the determination. makes the determination that extraordinarily could be amended out so that it would read a trial involving graphic, gruesome, or emotional evidence or testimony. Representative Curtula.
Through the chair, I think you need the word extraordinarily because, unfortunately, there are a lot of trials that might have graphic, gruesome, or emotional testimony, but this is for the extremely violent, the extremely graphic, things that, you know, people would not normally see. I mean, you could have emotional testimony in a fairly minor trial, but that wouldn't tend to set anyone off. Similarly, unfortunately, you could have graphic evidence, but, you know, this is for the extraordinary, the things that are out of the norm. So it probably just has a normal language in a normal dictionary definition. And I don't believe it's really a term of art. It's just in the normal understanding. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Herron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Curtula, I've been on grand jury, and though it may not be determined to be extremely graphic, gruesome, or emotional evidence, you know, there's obviously to some, that including myself, that it was, you know, it does reach a point, and so I guess that though I have no intention by any means of slowing this down, is that who decides when it's extraordinarily?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, it's the judge. It's going to be up to the judge.
I understand that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, just for the record.
Hannah, please continue.
And then starting on line 10, we have a list of the offenses where the judge may offer this counseling. And it goes through a list of first and second degree murder, manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, and then if you turn the page, the list continues to felonious assault, first degree through third, sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor, incest, online enticement, unlawful exploitation of a minor, and indecent exposure in second degree. And some of those are just listed by the statute number, so those terms that I've used would not appear in the bill because they're listed by the statute number. And then the second section is giving a timeline of 180 days after the jury is dismissed for when the judge can offer the counseling. And that's on line 4 of page 2. And then on line 5 of page 2, it talks about how the court system may contract with a mental health professional to offer the services. And then on line 7, it talks about how it could be individual or group counseling.
Thank you very much, Hannah. Are there questions for the bill sponsor? Any questions? Is it okay? Representative Grunberg.
Representative Herron asked the question of what is extraordinary. And just for the benefit of our young people here, generally the courts look, did you find any definition in there? No?
No.
Okay. Generally the courts look to the common ordinary usage to define terms. And there are a lot of cases and maybe a statute that say, you look to the way words are normally used, and they cite Webster's and that sort of thing. There are three cases in Alaska, though, that do define, use the word extraordinary, and they're used in somewhat different circumstances than this. And what the courts do, one of them dealt with a fishing violation and whether there were extraordinary circumstances would render somebody eligible for fishing points for a permit. And another one is in a divorce case, what may constitute extraordinary circumstances allowing the court to set aside a divorce property settlement. And the third circumstance was concerning also a request to get relief from judgment because of extraordinary circumstances. And the courts would look at the individual circumstances here, whether the evidence was so graphic that the person should justly be entitled to get psychological counseling. It would be made on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. Any questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we thank you very much. Mindy? If you'd come state your name and any affiliation for the record. You guys, this is my picture when I was in state close up here. This is with Governor Hammond. That was me in the picture.
You were a defendant?
Oh.
You were, what were you, a judge?
Quit it.
You're gotten handsomer.
Mindy, if you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
Hello, my name is Mindy Lobaugh, and I'm testifying on behalf of HB 52.
Welcome. If you'll offer your testimony, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity and all you do for the state of Alaska. I appreciate it.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
This bill represents a bridge that I and many other jurors did not have at the end of a trial. You arrive at the court given detailed instructions of what is expected of you as a juror and how the process of the trial will work. What the court system does not do is transition jurors out of the process after a trial. It is not uncommon to have major criminal trials run for many days. As you know, I served on the Rochelle Waterman trial 4 years ago, and it lasted approximately 10 days. Excuse me. For me, I arrived open and ready to do my civic duty as a juror, and by the end of the trial, I left there as a victim, feeling closed, confused, and very traumatized by the burden of knowledge I now carried. For 10 days, prosecutors went into great detail to help the jurors relive the events of an unsuspecting mother getting abducted from her home, tortured, and finally murdered. It was our duty to determine if the defendant, her daughter, was guilty of masterminding this tragedy against a woman who was a pillar in her community. I am here to tell you the media does not even come close to covering the depth of this trial. As a juror, we had access to piles of emails that detailed out various ways these men planned to kill the mother, the physical evidence, the photographs, and, of course, the hours of testimony that we sat through. For quite some time during and following that trial, eating for me was a near impossibility because of how sickened I was from this experience. To my friends and family, I became a stranger, and each night I prayed myself to sleep. One of my fellow jury mates was pregnant with her second child. She had shared the ultrasound pictures with us early on. By the end of the trial, she lost her baby and had to be excused.
Why?
When this trial ended with a hung jury, I turned to the presiding judge and I asked if the courts offer some kind of counseling or process to help jurors deal with this traumatizing information. The answer was no. For me, it was like having a door slammed in my face. And then you turn around and you find there's no bridge to help me return to the life that I had before this trial, a life that did not hold this kind of dark knowledge. It was at this point I felt the court had failed me as a juror doing my civic duty. Please help me to build the bridge by supporting HB 52, post-trial jury counseling. I may not have found closure with respects to this trial, but maybe you can bridge that for the jurors doing their civic duties in the future by passing HB 52. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm open for any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mindy? Mindy, we thank you for your public service to the jury system, which is one of the defining characteristics of the American justice system. We appreciate that, and what a horrendous jury, or not, I'm sure, not the jury, what a horrendous case for the jury to sit on, and a tragic story to hear about the stress that it caused a juror. Are there any questions for Mindy Loba? Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mindy, I just want to thank you for your service, and I will tell you that while that trial was going on, just the fact that it was happening in such near proximity to this building that we were working in, it affected a lot of people in this building, and we didn't even experience anything you know, that you went through. But I overheard a lot of people having conversations about what it must be like for the jury, and I know you said that papers didn't doing justice isn't the right word because that sounds positive, but the papers didn't portray accurately really what you were dealing with. I know what I read in the papers was enough. So, but thank you very, very much, and I want you to know that many Alaskans were thinking about you while you were going through that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Ms. Lobo? Seeing none, we thank you very much for coming before the committee. We appreciate your testimony. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have sat on several coroner's juries, and those are generally to determine such things as if somebody's disappeared, whether they're dead, and if so, the date and time of the occurrence, and fourth, the cause of death, whether it's natural, accidental, suicide, or homicide. And that, too, can be traumatizing. I had to declare a friend of mine dead. And I still think about that.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for Mindy Lobaugh? Seeing none, we thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else here in the room who wishes to testify on this piece of legislation? Is there anybody online who wishes to testify? We don't have anyone online. I'm going to close public testimony. This public testimony is now closed. We're going to bring the bill back before the committee. Does any of the members of the committee have amendments that they wish to offer? No amendments. We have the bill before us.
Oh, you had asked me, Mr. Chair, to get the statutes.
Sorry,
you still want to do
that? No, we're past that. But I thank you. We thank you, though. The chair would entertain a motion to move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill Number 5226-LS0294/A with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there an objection?
Mr. Chairman, I object for purposes of demonstration.
So Representative Lynn objects. Madam Secretary, will you please take the roll?
Representative Holmes is not present. Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
Representative Herron?
Yes.
Representative Gatto is not present. Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes.
Member Evans?
Yes.
Member Peterson?
Oh, yeah.
Member Neumkesser?
Yeah.
Representative Ramros?
Yes.
Five representatives, yes. Three members, yes.
Thank you. So with a vote of 5+3 to 0, House Bill 52 passes from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. All right, before us is House Bill 323. And this is by the House Rules Committee. We have Doug Wooliver that will be presenting to us, and we have available online Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defense Agency to answer any questions. Doug, it's a privilege to have you before the committee. If you will take us through House Bill 323, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Doug Wooliver, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. The Supreme Court occasionally asks for a bill to be introduced on its behalf through the Rules Committees, and we've done so in this case to add a new Superior Court judge seat in Anchorage. This has to go through the bill process because the statutes establish how many judges there are in each judicial district. This is in the 3rd District, and it's our intention not only to add a judge in Anchorage, but to have this judge preside over civil cases. And there are a couple of areas in our civil caseload that have created an unsustainable workload for our civil judges. Not only are they the busiest Superior Court judges in the state in Anchorage, but there are two particular issues. One is China cases, the child need of aid cases. The numbers of those cases have not increased dramatically, but the amount of work that the court time the Superior Court judges spend on them has increased significantly. And that's because of a couple of changes in the way we handle those cases. In the past, standing masters did an awful lot of the work in these cases, who are like assistants to the Superior Court. But more and more Superior Court judges themselves are sitting on these cases through all aspects of the case. It's a much better case model. It allows the judge to have a much better understanding of the families involved. It helps them through the process a lot better. And it's agencies like it, the attorneys like it. It's a better model, but it does take more time for Superior Court judges. Another aspect of our China practice that has changed and increased the workload of the Superior Court is we're having more and more status hearings. When a China case comes to the court, initially, the family, which is in some sort of crisis, has usually a long laundry list of things they have to do in order to get their children back. In the past, the court would say, okay, you know, you come back here in 120 days and hopefully you've got your life together, you've done all these things. But a model that the courts have picked up through the therapeutic courts is more and more status hearings. So rather than just say, come back in 120 days, they'll say, come back in 2 weeks and we're going to see where you are. Helps keep people on track. It increases the likelihood that they'll be successful and they'll get their kids back, which is the ultimate goal of the entire China process, is, as you know, family reunification. So we're doing a better job with China cases, but it does take more time for the Superior Court judges. The other area of our caseload that has changed, not so much in numbers, but in how we handle them, or at least an aspect of them, is in our family law cases. Our family law cases have not increased all that much, but what has increased dramatically is the number of unrepresented litigants that are coming to court. For a variety of reasons, more and more people are choosing to try and litigate their family law matters without the assistance of counsel. The biggest reason, of course, is just plain cost. This isn't unique to Alaska. It's a phenomenon all over the country. And Alaska courts, like courts all over the country, have wrestled with how to deal with unrepresented litigants. There are a lot more work for the court. Attorneys help cases move along in many different ways, largely because they know the legal issues involved, and they know how to file motions. They know when to file motions. And they can focus the court's attention. Unfortunately, unrepresented litigants, they're just as important as cases with lawyers, except they don't necessarily know how to file motions. They don't necessarily know how to focus on the legally relevant issues. It takes a lot of judicial time to help them through the process. And our Supreme Court and our court rules require judges to kind of bend over backwards to make sure that unrepresented litigants don't get tripped up by rules and things that lawyers have to follow. But that extra work takes a lot of time. So we're asking for one new Superior Court judge. You could easily ask for more. But what we're going to try to do between the time this bill passes and maybe next year, if we're back for more judges, is to implement some other procedural changes in how we handle particularly the pro se cases. Adding a new judge is always the most expensive way to solve a case management problem. We're going to try and hire more staff to help better manage pro se cases, to make sure that they have all their paperwork before the hearing starts, which is a frequent problem, particularly getting financial information for child support awards and things like that. So we're going to try some experiments in these other areas, and hopefully it'll reduce our need for more judges, but we will almost certainly be back before very long for more. But right at this point, we're just asking for one judge, and I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going to the last paragraph in the sponsor statement, clearly we can all read that, but what would be the caseload of this new judge?
Caseloads in Anchorage, even with this new judge, there's a couple of ways to calculate it, but it's about 600.
But just one judge?
About 600 cases per judge.
Per judge. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For many years while I was in practice, for you, I was very much in favor of expanding the use of pro tems, senior members of the bar, and training them because, for the benefit of the young people particularly, lawyers have an ethical duty to provide what's called pro bono work free legal care. Mm-hmm. That's an ethical aspiration. In other words, it's not required in this state, but they're encouraged to do it. We're encouraged to do it. And I think there are some excellent people that, and they wouldn't necessarily have to be really senior, they could be other people too who are well suited for it, educationally, professionally, and temperamentally, with maybe some minor stipend, but maybe not at all. And they take a case or two or serve as a special master with some training. And number one, and I'm speaking personally, at one time I thought about being a judge and even applied. And I wasn't selected to go up to the Judicial Council. The Judicial Council, they asked if I'd reapply, and I said I didn't know. And then I became a hearing officer in some cases, and it showed me that I didn't want to be a judge. I'd been a law clerk, but it's a certain type of a temperament to require to be a judge. You have to be able to listen and not make amendments. And it's in some ways like being the Speaker of the House. You preside, but you don't get into the hurly-burly of the courtroom down at the bar. There are some people who are thinking about being judges, and this would give them a good opportunity, particularly at the lower level, to see whether they're well-suited and for people to make some evaluations there. But also, it would, I think, be a way of, as more senior people, to give some time back in their field of expertise, family law or criminal law, whatever it might be. And I never got very far with that suggestion. And I'm wondering, maybe it's time that the court system consider that. It wouldn't cost very much, and it would speed the system along, provide judges, maybe in some cases where there isn't a judge now, you know, various things, or in Anchorage, through the chair. What do you think?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. Well, the statutes determine who is a judge, and you have to be appointed by the governor. We do have pro tem judges who are retired judges, and we use those extensively. But they were at one time appointed by the governor. It would take a statutory change to allow a non-appointed person to serve as a temporary judge.
Or through the chair, possibly a special master.
Special master through the chair. We do use special masters occasionally, but not on routine cases.
Through the chair, may I follow up, please?
Oh, yes.
The court system, and I'll just say, I'm asking you maybe to carry this back, consider a rule change in some manner that might allow that to be used. A previous area court administrator who retired to California many years ago was interested in this, and then he left, and I think they tried it for a while, many, many years ago. Maybe you could check that out. I think it might be helpful. I don't know that it solved the problem, but it might solve some problem.
Through the chair, thank you. I will take that back.
Thank you, Doug. A comment and then a question. First of all, a comment. Representative Gruenberg, I speak for all of us at this table, I think. All self-deprecation aside, your empathy for the most vulnerable among society, your kindness, your disposition, your intellectual curiosity, you would make a fine judge. That's heartfelt.
Well, thank you. You know, I had a few cases. I sat as a human rights commissioner, a hearing officer, and I still think, wonder if I made the right decision. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Now my question. Doug, I presume that a judge is a little bit like a fighter pilot, that they have to come with a whole squadron to support the jet. I see that the fiscal note is $500,000 a year, thereabouts, for a judge. And members, if you'll see on the fiscal note system, it says Alaska Court System Fiscal Note Calculation for HB 323. Can you take me through the cost of a judgeship and how that works? And then I don't see an allowance in here for the law enforcement piece. I imagine that wouldn't necessarily be the court system fiscal note. That would probably be the public safety fiscal note. Can you take me through the fiscal note, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Well, of course, as you might suspect, the biggest single cost is the cost of the judge himself or herself, and that $257,300 is salary and benefits. The every judge comes with an in-court clerk that monitors and records and manages all of the courtroom activity while and works with the judge on all of his or her cases. Every Superior Court judge comes with a single law clerk. There's a cost for that and an administrative assistant. And you'll also see down below there are one-time costs. Those are the costs that roughly $40,000, the computers, desks, chairs, electronic equipment in the courtroom that it costs to set up a courtroom and set up the offices. Sometimes, not in this note, but in other notes, if we were to add two judges, for example, there would be capital costs as well because we don't have another courtroom. If we were to add a judge in Palmer or something, we would need to have a significant capital cost because there isn't another courtroom. In this case, there will be a remodel, but it was part of last year's capital budget, so we are already creating a new Superior Court suite in the Anchorage Courthouse.
Thank you very much, Doug. Are there any other questions for Mr. Woolliver? We do have Quinlan Steiner online. Any questions for Quinlan? Seeing none,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes, to the Chair, Mr. Steiner, I appreciate your coming and being available to testify. Was there something that the agency was particularly interested in or concerned about with respect to the addition of a Superior Court judge in Anchorage, through the Chair?
Through the Chair, this is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. No particular concern with respect to adding a judge, although this tends to put pressure on our agency. It'll be a little bit different than what the court system is describing because much of the work that's being shifted from masters to Superior Court judges, as Mr. Woolliver described, are things that we attended already. We do anticipate some pressure on us, but are intending to try to solve some of that pressure by work scheduling. That's our primary trouble. We have fewer attorneys than judges, so placing bodies in courtroom trouble, not necessarily the caseload or a shifting of the case. So that was my only.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunberg.
I don't know if anybody else had difficulty hearing him. Understanding. I did.
Would you like me to restate his answer?
No, but if everybody else heard him.
All right, Quinlan. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Are there any more questions for Quinlan or for Mr. Woolliver? Seeing none, we thank you very much, Doug. You made an excellent case for the position. Is there anybody else in the room who wishes to testify? Is there anybody online who wishes to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. We now have the bill back before us. Is there any committee discussion on the bill? Thank you. Seeing no discussion, the chair would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill number 32326-LSI386/A with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Without objection, House Bill 323 passes from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. It's 5 minutes after 2. We have before us House Bill 138. The CS needs to be introduced.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I will move that we consider or adopt the blank CS for House Bill 138, which is labeled at the top right-hand corner so our new members can look at it here. The number is 26LS0351/T is in tango, dated 2/4/10. And maybe somebody, Mr. Chair, would object so we can have the differences.
Object.
Representative Herron objects for the purposes of discussion. And who do we have presenting? Bring it on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Thomas Riker, and I'm a staffer for Representative Carl Gatto.
Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you. So basically, the differences in this bill are just to bring it in line with Senator Wilikowski's SB 214. This is now a House companion bill to that bill. The basic provisions are the same. Killing an animal through the use of poison or a decompression chamber or knowingly causing severe or prolonged physical pain and suffering, those are all Class C felonies under this bill, and they were as they were under the original language of the bill. Class A misdemeanors for negligently causing severe or prolonged physical pain and suffering, and also a Class A misdemeanor for killing an animal with the intent to intimidate or terrorize another person. Both of those offenses would be elevated to a Class C felony upon the second offense within 10 years. So really the only difference is that our previous bill established animal cruelty in the first degree and animal cruelty in the second degree. That language is no longer in the bill, but the provisions for the individual acts are the same.
Okay. Any questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we thank you, Thomas, for coming before us. We have wishing to testify. We have Lieutenant Chris Sell. We have Kayla Epstein, and we have Sandy Samaniego, our domestic violence and sexual assault chief. Come on up, Lieutenant. Pleasure to have you before the committee. If you'll introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Lieutenant Chris Sell. I represent the 913 members of the Alaska Peace Officers Association. I also represent the Juneau Police Department and the City and Borough of Juneau. I'm also speaking for my own slightly spoiled and slightly overweight chocolate Labrador named Addison. I'm here to support increased penalties for animal cruelty as contained in House Bill 138. This morning at 8:56, a woman called JPD to complain her husband verbally abuses her and physically abuses her dog. According to today's report, the husband kicks the dog and locks it in the bathroom for days. 2 days ago, she said her husband told her he had a bullet for the dog. The woman is pretty uncooperative with the investigation because she doesn't have any other place to go, especially a place where she can take her dog. Wouldn't it be nice if the officers investigating this animal abuse this morning could have investigated as a felony or laying the groundwork for a future felony? Under this amendment, that's what would happen. As a fairly new patrol officer, I worked a serial domestic violence case on a man who was beating his wife and terrorizing his children. During one assault on his family, the man was raging at his wife when his attention was drawn to a pet bird in a cage making noise. Wanting to show his family that when he talks, everybody's quiet, he grabbed the bird out of the cage and threw it against the wall, breaking its wing. I ended up in trial on that case and got to tell the jury about what happened. I could tell by the expressions on the faces of the jury members that they were sickened by what the man did. Without showing any studies on the link between animal abuse and domestic violence, the jurors knew intuitively, as most of us do, that someone who will pick on a helpless animal will have no boundaries when it comes to abusing people. Still, the defendant didn't get any significant consequences for harming the bird. Had this change in legislation been in place, his actions might have been a felony, or led to a felony, and he would have gotten more jail time than he did. Lots of studies show the link between animal abuse and domestic violence and other violent crime. It's just a known fact in my line of work. But what I remember is two little blonde girls, a thin, very nervous woman whose hard years showed in her face, and a large, angry man who would use anything he could reach to terrorize them. Equally as well documented as the link between animal cruelty and domestic violence is the link between children and teens involved in animal abuse and going on to continued violence against people, including serial murder. Some examples that have been cited in books and magazines are Jeffrey Dahmer, Albert DeSalvo, who's the Boston Strangler, and Dennis Rader, the BTK killer. Mitchell Zukoff of the Boston Globe wrote in 1999 about how Columbine High School killers Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold used to horrify classmates with descriptions of how Harris and Klebold would mutilate animals. That pair went on to kill 12 classmates, taunting many of them before the fatal shots. If animal cruelty were taken more seriously, maybe someone would have followed up on those tales, and maybe the Columbine Massacre could have been avoided. My dog, Addison, would no doubt tell me to be here if she could talk. She looks at me with such faith and trust that I bought this refrigerator magnet that says I want to be the person my dog thinks I am. I would like for ladies and gentlemen of the committee, Mr. Chair, to think about your own pet right now and take this opportunity to be as great a person as your dog thinks you are. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the Lieutenant? Lieutenant, I do have a question for you. One of my chief concerns, having chaired the Judiciary Committee now into my fourth year, is recognizing, you know, that in the same way that marijuana can be a gateway drug to worse narcotics, I'm quite clear that animal abuse can be a gateway to domestic violence. And we're all troubled by domestic violence. On the other hand, another concern that I have is that we are creating a permanent underclass of felons, and I worry for that. Can you tell me your thoughts on trying to balance the two? Understand that, you know, domestic violence toward a bird is upsetting to us, but whether that's a felony or not, I'm not certain. I mean, small children can be cruel to animals. We don't want 9-year-olds that are, you know, committing felons that presumably could be in our juvenile court system for cruel experimentation.
Sure. Mr. Chair, what I would like you to consider is the wording of the bill about the purpose to intimidate or in some way terrorize people as part of the domestic violence. The damage to the animal is not the intended target. It is simply a matter to control the people in the family, much the way it has been known for people to kill the family dog in front of the children to keep the children in line. So I understand your concerns, but I do believe the law enforcement community understands the nuances and has been involved with pets being used as tools to terrorize people. So I understand what you mean, but really the intent of the perpetrators under this crime is much greater than targeting an animal.
Thomas? Sure, please. You just pull a chair up.
You pull up another chair.
So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would just like to point out that I'm sorry, and I'm Thomas Riker, staff for Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Thomas.
I would just like to point out through the chair that under this bill, seriously injuring or killing a pet would be a Class C, or an animal would be a Class C felony. Terrorizing or hurting an animal in order to terrorize somebody else would be a Class A misdemeanor. If you seriously injure a human, the typical charge is a Class A or Class B felony. If you poison a person to death, obviously it's an unclassified felony. And if negligent child endangerment is a Class C felony, and stalking is a Class A misdemeanor on the first offense and a Class C felony on the second offense. So we're really looking at proportionality based on the actions that have been undertaken, not necessarily making sure that every crime against an animal has a lower penalty or a less severe penalty than a crime against a human being. Because again, as Lieutenant Sell was speaking to, you know, we want to cut these people off before they move on to hurting human beings. But even in that, we've tried to keep it proportional based on the actions that they're taking. So okay. I just wanted to speak to that. Thank you.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know. I'm going to ask both of you. So thank you, Lieutenant Sell. Thank you, Thomas, for being here. I have some questions. I am convinced that I know that this type of behavior does lead to other behaviors. I have far more information on that than I wish that I did know. But my question pertains to how the bill is written. And when we use words like the killing of an animal or the word poison even, how do farm animals fit into that when a farmer humanely puts their a sick cow down or a sick dog. I mean, sometimes that's done with a poison that causes almost an instant death. It's not, I mean, that's a way of life for people that live on farm. Is this bill written so that it would differentiate? I mean, I know officers would know the difference when they go to the scene and see that, but can you speak to that?
Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair, yes, the language of our bill does not amend the section in current animal cruelty law, which has exceptions for veterinary medicine. I believe there's a myriad of exceptions, but just some that are included. Veterinary medicine, animal breeding practices, which actually we had stronger language protecting farmers originally, and then we were contacted by legal services to let us know that in current statute, when it says animal husbandry practices, that has always been interpreted to include all farming practices. And so they felt that extra provisions specifically mentioning farmers were superfluous in this bill because animal husbandry is covered. We also have exceptions for dog mushing. I'm not familiar with the practice, but pulls and in other, livestock shows, those are all exempted as well. So basically, legitimate practices are all exempted under current law, and this law just speaks to things that wouldn't be covered under what are generally accepted by professional guidelines, whether you be a farmer or a vet or whatever your profession may be.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair. So, Thomas, if, say I have a family pet and that's sick, and I make a decision that, or my family, we make a decision that the pet needs to be put down rather than suffer, or maybe we can't afford to take it to the vet to have it euthanized, because that, I believe, costs about $150. Mm-hmm. If, I don't want to, traumatize anybody, but on a farm or where I grew up or those very humanely, the animal was taken out and shot and died. That's still legal?
Yes, it is.
They might not be a mushing dog. They might not be a...
Right. Through the chair, the bill, that's the reason that we specifically mentioned poison and decompression chambers, because in that case, first of all, there would have to be a complainant. So unless a member of your family takes it to the police, it's not going to be an issue. But also, even if, say, they did for whatever reason, if you can demonstrate that dog was sick and also that they didn't suffer prolonged suffering, which is another reason that language is in the bill. If you shoot a dog and it dies, the prosecution is not going to be able to demonstrate that there was prolonged physical suffering, and so you would be exempted from the statute.
Okay. And just a final follow-up, Mr. Chair. I don't want anyone to misinterpret my questions as I am in support of any type of animal cruelty or not. I just really want to make sure that farmers can do what they need to do, and responsible people can take care of what they need to. So thank you.
If I could, Mr. Chair and Representative Dahlstrom, the Alaska Farm Bureau is actually on board with this bill as well as SB 214, and we worked with them extensively to make sure that it did address their concerns. So,
do we have a letter, Mr. Chair, from them?
We don't. I actually have, I was just given this today, I apologize. I actually have their packet for this legislative session. Specifically mentions SB 214, HB 138, and HB 6, all of which they support.
Thank you.
Thomas, the sponsor statement says that this is a companion bill to SB 214. Where is SB 214?
If you don't have a copy of that, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I thought I included it.
Where is it in the process is my question.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lynn?
I believe it's in Senate Judiciary.
No, it's
They've
in
had a hearing on it already.
Yeah. Through the chair, it's in Senate Finance. Is it?
I'm sorry. No,
Representative Lynn.
I believe it's in. Well, let's ask my staffer where it is. But I believe it's in Senate.
He had it right.
He said he had it right. He keeps his job.
Whoa.
You usually do.
I apologize.
It's in Senate Judiciary because when they were discussing my HB 6, that topic came up. And so they were debating both of these bills.
And Thomas, is there a relationship between Representative Gatto and Senator Wilikowski? Is there an agreement as to which bill is going to go first, the House version or the Senate version?
Through the chair, the Senate version is farther along, and so it's basically just whichever one can work its way through the process the fastest, since the language is identical. But we have also been working with Representative Lynn's office to incorporate HB 6 as well in the conference process.
All right, I appreciate that. So, Thomas, the next question for me is the police officer in Houston that killed 8 animals. Did he commit a felony? Was he instructed to commit a felony by the mayor of Houston?
Through the chair, while I would be hesitant to speak to an ongoing legal proceeding, I would say that, again, the same answer applies as to Representative Dahlstrom's question, in the sense that if you humanely kill an animal as part of a standard practice, for instance, putting down animals in an animal shelter, that would be exempted in this bill.
Let me re-ask the question. I suspect that the law enforcement officer would not have committed a felony. But did the mayor of Houston potentially instruct the law enforcement officer and thereby commit a felony? It's a very interesting question. According to the reports that I read in the newspaper, arguably the mayor instructed the law enforcement officer to use a bullet on 8 animals, and the press account was the public found that it was an inhumane way to dispose of the animals. May you get an answer, and then we'll go to you, Representative Lynn. Thomas?
Again, Mr. Chair, I would be hesitant to speak to an ongoing legal proceeding. They'll determine that. I would say,
I'm asking
though,
your opinion. I'm not asking.
Under current law, while it might not be a felony, the provisions are the same. So our bill is just raising the penalties, but if it's illegal under our bill, it's illegal under current law as well.
So what speaks to this bill if somebody instructs somebody else to kill an animal? Then has that person committed a felony?
I believe, Mr. Chair, that it would work through the regular legal process. You know, if it's legal culpability for an action that you encourage someone else to do is a matter for the courts in individual situations.
Lieutenant Sell, what's your sense of that? I mean, in this particular case, we have a mayor who gave instructions to use bullets to kill animals, which the general public indicated was inhumane. What happens if an individual instructs somebody else to cause cruelty to animals? Think about a 20-year-old who instructs a 15-year-old to be cruel to an animal. Where does the culpability lie?
That's a tough one. Of course, officers often put down animals that are injured. It's part of our normal duties to end suffering for animals. As far as where you have an uninjured animal and somebody ordered or encouraged to kill that animal, certainly the culpability would lie with the instigator. And that would be, as every case that comes up is different in its circumstances. So I'm not exactly sure how this bill would affect that. In the Houston situation, as we always see in the legal system, the public is interpreting what they're finding is acceptable and is speaking to that through the courts.
Thank you. Representative Lennon, comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just speaking for myself only, if that question were asked to me, I would be very, very reluctant to offer an opinion or address the issue, because here we are in state legislature in an official committee hearing, and I could see potential for that causing difficulties in the prosecution or defense of that case.
Understood, but the issue that I'm getting at is we look at some of the sexual assault issues that we have taken up. What happens if an adult, I had three people break into my house a number of years ago. It's what brought me into public service. And it was adults with minors who intentionally were encouraging minors to commit felonies, because for the minors, the penalties were less than they were for the adults. And Lieutenant, you're familiar with this kind of a pattern. So how does this bill address an adult who encourages a minor to commit cruelty to animals, which is really very much parallel to what we've seen in sexual assault legislation that's come before the committee before?
Mr. Chair, I would probably consider addressing that through a different law, which is contributing to the delinquency of a minor, which is when an adult encourages any minor to commit an illegal act. There's other legislation to speak to that.
And is that a felony or a misdemeanor?
That is a misdemeanor, to encourage.
So let me get this straight then. So then an adult could encourage a minor to commit a felony?
Under contributing, it would be a misdemeanor. Because
so the adult would be responsible for a misdemeanor, but the teenager would have committed a felony?
No, the charge is against the adult.
The misdemeanor?
Yes.
Yes, and the felony would have been committed by the minor who was guilty of cruelty to animals. If an adult encouraged a minor to kill an animal in an inhumane way.
You would have to examine the culpable mindset. That would be something for the prosecutor to examine.
Very interesting. Representative Herron and then Brunberg.
Well, two questions, Mr. Chairman, but that one following up that immediately, isn't that if there was an adult that was encouraging a minor to harm an animal, could that be an aggravating factor by the judge because they're controlling the child to commit essentially a felony?
I think we've gone into the prosecutorial realm.
But I mean, so, yeah, I understand that.
I would certainly have that discussion with the prosecutor.
Then, Mr. A follow-up is, and this is brought up by the lieutenant, and then, of course, the domestic violence initiative that we're debating throughout the legislature. Could cruelty to animals, as you characterized it, as a control or terrorizing tool, could this? Maybe this is a rhetorical question. Is for everyone. Could this be used as an aggravating factor in a DV crime, domestic violence crime?
If there's a companion DV crime, if the animal is taking the physical abuse in order to mentally and emotionally control the individuals, you may struggle with where the DV crime against the individuals would be. You'd be based on fear, and certainly it could be considered an aggravator if there was a physical assault against a human, but what you can also run into is that the animal is the receiver of the physical violence.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Just briefly, I'll be getting into this when we take up amendments. I have an amendment that will deal with this, and it should be in the packet. Lieutenant, I don't know if you've received a copy of the proposal.
I have not.
I always have them with me, extra copies of any amendments. And I'll bring that up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions for Lieutenant Sell or for Thomas? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. If we can have Kayla Epstein next, please. Kayla Epstein. Kayla, if you could introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation, please.
Well, as you all know, I'm Kayla Epstein, but for the record, I'm Kayla Epstein, and I'm a member of the Anchorage Animal Care and Control Advisory Board. The board unanimously voted in favor of this bill. As everyone else has pointed out, there is a very close tie between domestic violence and animal abuse, and child sexual abuse as well. Most people instinctively want to protect small, helpless creatures from harm. A friend told me this story about himself. He and his sister were being abused by an uncle. And when he started to cry, his sister said, "Don't do that to my brother. Whatever you want to me, but please don't hurt my brother." And that is exactly how abusers use animals. They will threaten to kill or hurt an animal in order to get the same response and to ensure silence. And while we like to think of pedophiles as strangers, the sad truth is that 70% of them are family members or people who are well known to the family. Animal abuse to animals is an aid to perpetrators in cases of domestic violence. It is to demonstrate the power and control over the family to isolate, to perpetuate an environment of fear, to prevent the victim from leaving or to coerce her in, or him into returning, or to punish the victim, or for even showing independence. 71% of pet-owning women entering women's shelters have reported that their batterers have injured, maimed, killed, or threatened family pets specifically for revenge or for psychological control. 25% of abused women stay in that situation because of threats to their animals, whether they are farm animals or their personal pets. In homes where a spouse is abused, a child is twice as likely to be abused if there is also animal abuse. In some states, people who investigate domestic violence and animal control officers are cross-trained because they have found such a great link between these two crimes. It is very hard sometimes to convict someone of either domestic violence or sexual abuse of children. I heard testimony in the Senate Judiciary Committee of two cases where people were actually able to be put in jail because of their animal abuse, where they were not able to be charged for their human abuse. In one case, a woman had been, where officers had been called over and over and over to that home, and the woman refused to testify for her husband. She was able to testify to protect because the husband shot her dog. And children often are reluctant to testify about their own abuse, but they will testify to protect that little creature that they feel responsible for. As someone who's on the Animal Control Advisory Board, I cannot tell you anything about the law. I really can't. I can't talk about another case, but I do know that animals, healthy animals, are regularly put down simply because they are not wanted by anyone. And I don't see that you could arrest someone for a felony for putting down these unwanted dogs that were in an animal control situation. My non-legal opinion.
Thank you very much.
I thank you for your time.
Are there any questions for Kayla? Seeing none around the table, we thank you very much for your testimony.
In trouble now.
You have a question?
No. He was going to.
I controlled myself.
He was going to propose to her again.
You wouldn't dare.
No. I wouldn't dare.
All right. Thank you very much, Kayla. And finally, Sandy, if you want to come up. We have, for the benefit of the members, we have Rose Munafo of the Department of Corrections, Lieutenant Rodney Dial, my favorite state trooper, is available for questions. Quinlan Steiner is available for questions. Sandy, if you introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chair, it's kind of unusual. I don't know if I need to put on the record that that was my wife. I think that might be considered a conflict.
Your lovely wife.
My only wife.
Rarely a source wife. Of conflict.
So I guess I need to put that on and ask to be excused.
You're excused.
There's the door.
Sandy, welcome. If you'd introduce yourself.
Seriously, somebody has to object, or I got to go.
Object.
Sorry, Kim.
Wasn't going to be me. Sandy, if you'd introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation and any testimony you have today, please.
Thank you, Chair Ramos. Members of the committee, my name is Sandy Samaniego. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. There's not a whole lot I can add to what's already been said before me. I just wanted to come in and voice the council's support of this bill, or the intent of this bill as we understand it. I'm not an expert in the field, but I do know you cannot work in a domestic violence shelter very long without running into stories where animal pet cruelty is used as an instrument of control over victims. And because of this, we want to speak in support of the bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Sandy? I don't see it,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, I'm going to be offering an amendment, and I hope the witnesses will stick around because
I may have a question to ask. It deals with exactly this issue. It'll make it an aggravator for somebody who's convicted of a felony if they have a history of animal abuse. Okay. So thank you.
Thank you.
Sandy, thank you very much. Can we go to Lieutenant Dial? Lieutenant Dial, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am online.
Can you state your name for the record and your affiliation?
Yes, for the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with the Alaska State Troopers.
Lieutenant Dial, I visited, I got diverted to Sitka on Monday, and I visited the Trooper Academy, got to talk to a class of troopers and a class of VPSOs.
I heard that the weather was pretty bad trying to get into Juneau, so.
Yes, but Sitka was beautiful, and you got a great bunch of young cadets that are coming up, that are coming through that Trooper Academy, and it was a privilege, and I talked well of you to both of those classes, and I never like to miss an opportunity to talk to Lieutenant Rodney Dial.
Thank you, sir. I do appreciate that.
Any other questions for Lieutenant Dial?
Mr. Chairman, if I could add one thing to what Lieutenant Sell did.
Yes, go ahead, Lieutenant Dial.
In addition to contributing to the delinquency of a minor, if you had an adult or somebody in a position of authority over a minor trying to encourage or direct them to harm an animal, they could also potentially be charged with either solicitation or even potentially coercion. So there's a couple other areas there that law enforcement could use to address that.
All right. Thank you very much, Lieutenant Dial. We appreciate your service. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, we thank you very much. Is there anybody else in the room who wishes to testify on this issue? Is there anybody online? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. We bring the bill back before the committee. We take amendments. Representative Grunberg?
Mr. Chair, before we do that,
yes, Representative
I would again offer the T version and ask that the objection be withdrawn now that we've talked about it.
The T version?
The CS, the proposed CS. I think, Representative Heron, you objected.
We have the blank CS before us. CS for House Bill number 138, the blank version before us.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunberg.
If we may ask, did we actually adopt, because there was an objection, and I don't know if the objection was withdrawn. I think technically it has to be, so we have the CS before
No,
us.
We have the CS, we have the blank CS before us. There was no objection.
There was not.
There was not. The okay. blank CS, is that correct, Susan?
Representative Heron did object.
For discussion.
Yeah, so he needs to withdraw his objection.
Withdrawn.
Representative Heron withdraws his objection. We have the blank CS before us. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer an amendment that has been labeled T1 in the upper right-hand corner and ask that that be labeled amendment number one.
We have amendment number one before us.
And I would move the amendment.
Representative Grunberg moves amendment number one. Is there an objection?
Jay, here's another copy. That should be in everybody's packet.
Is there an objection to amendment number one? Without objection, amendment number one is adopted. Is there any? Are there any more amendments to the CS for House Bill 138? Seeing none, the committee would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair,
Representative, Lane.
I would like to make a comment before we vote on this.
So
I do support Representative Gatto's bill because it's appropriate punishment for these damaged, sicko, and sadistic people who violently abuse animals. It's like spring training before major league crimes against humans. And I think people like this need more than a slap on the hand. They in fact, need handcuffs on the wrist. Certain egregious cases of animal cruelty that this bill addresses rise to a level that speak more, we heard before, about the perpetrator than the victim or property. And some people refer to animal cruelty as a gateway crime to domestic violence and sexual assault of humans, yeah. But I see it more as a stair-step kind of crime. And these violent offenders are at the top of the steps and on the threshold of serious crimes against children and humans. I think Representative Gatto's bill complements the bestiality bill we heard earlier in the committee that's now in the other chamber. This bill strengthens the net, while my bill helps secure make sure that there are no holes through the net from which your perpetrators can escape. And it's a good bill, and I do intend to support it.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. Are there any other comments on CS for House Bill 138?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I think on behalf of myself and Representative Gatto, and correct me if I'm wrong, Thomas, that we appreciate your scheduling the bill and strengthening it moving it along. Thank you, really, very much. I think it's on behalf of also the Epstein group.
Excellent. Are there any other comments? Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 138, 26-LS0351/T with amendment number 1 and attached physical note and individual recommendations.
Without objection, CS for House Bill 138 passes from the committee. Any remarks from our new members today that you'd like to have read onto the record? Did you have an interesting experience this afternoon? You can't just nod. You got to speak into a microphone. state your name.
My name's Billy. This was a great experience. It gave me a little bit more idea of how you guys work, you know, and what you guys exactly do. And overall, it was a great experience.
Any other remarks, Kelly or Tiana?
I think this is actually really good. We've done classwork and everything, and I really respect this bill. I've been against animal cruelty ever since I can remember. My mom and my aunt, my grandma work with it, so I was really glad to be here for this bill, especially. It means a lot.
Well said, Kelly. No comments? Okay. All right, so with that, it's 2:45, and we're adjourned.